Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. Native Americans have taken center stage in many recent news stories, and we're very fortunate to be joined today by one of the most knowledgeable people in the country about this. From 2012 to 2016, UNM law professor Kevin Washburn was the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs in the Obama administration. That's the highest policy position regarding Indians in the executive branch. Prior to that, Professor Washburn was Dean of the UNM Law School. Kevin Washburn, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Steve.
So, Kevin, I'd like to spend most of the show on policy, sort of Indian health, education, and welfare, the basics. But I'm sure listeners would like to learn a little more about you. And about all I know is that you're a member of the Chickasaw Nation. You grew up in Oklahoma, and you went to Yale Law School. So that leaves a lot of blanks. I wonder if you could fill in some for us.
You bet. Well, I've had a career in law, about half of it in public service and about half of it in academia. And it's been a very rewarding career. But my passion is federal Indian law. I always joke that I don't know why anyone is a tax lawyer, but I know why I do Indian law. I'm an Indian.
That makes sense.
And so it's been a great career. I love teaching and I love public service. And I've been able to combine both of those things throughout my career. And it's been, just like I said, it's been terrific.
So you grew up in Oklahoma on the reservation? Or
on the former reservation,
on
that's
the former
right.
Reservation.
Yeah, the reservations were disestablished in Oklahoma during the allotment era.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and so there are former reservation boundaries, and my tribe, you know, encompassed, I think, around 10 counties in Oklahoma, and those reservation boundaries don't formally exist anymore, but they do informally, and I grew up mostly within the reservation boundaries.
So, like, when you went to school, was it a school populated mostly by Native Americans, or was it mixed?
Well, Oklahoma is curious because the tribes and the Native Americans there are very assimilated because they've been interacting with Europeans, you know, in my case, my tribe's case, since the very early 1600s. So there are a lot of people in Oklahoma that are, say, part Native American and maybe a tribal citizen, but may not have brown skin. So the tribes are throughout the state, and there are, I believe, 33 tribes in Oklahoma. Some of them were removed there.
Wow, no, I didn't know that either.
Well, so Oklahoma was originally called Indian Country, and numerous tribes were removed from other parts of the country. You've perhaps heard the Cherokee Trail of Tears, for example.
Yes, of course.
And they were removed to Oklahoma. You know, Oklahoma is now a state. It's not Indian Country any longer, Indian Territory, but the tribes are you know, very vibrant in the state.
So the education you received was just public school by the state.
Public education, yeah, in small towns in Oklahoma, and then the University of Oklahoma. I'm a Sooner.
Okay, and then you end up going to Yale Law School, and you know when I was also a law teacher, and so I sort of followed Yale, and Yale was a place where, first of all, it was generally regarded as the best law school in the country, well, at least when I was going to law school. And second of all, it was regarded as a place where people went to get into the academic world. And I'm wondering if that was part of your thinking.
Not necessarily at the time, but a lot of my classmates went into academia, and my classmates are law professors and law deans all over the country now, and some of them are federal judges or United States senators, and it was a real opportunity. One of the strengths of Yale Law School is it's actually kind of like UNM Law School in that it's got a lot of professors and not very many students, so the student-faculty ratio is terrific.
And that makes for a great education.
It makes for a great education because you know your teachers well, and there's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. You can't sit in a lecture hall in the back of the room and no one notices you're there. You know, these smaller schools tend to be far better for education.
So then after law school, at some point, you go to Washington, you also work as a U.S. attorney, right?
I did.
In tribal matters, or?
I did, for the most part. Yeah, I tell you, when you go to law school and you're a Native American and people say, well, what are you going to do after law school? Are you going to go help your people? You can't very well say no to that question. You'd seem like a jerk. So I have to say, I rebelled against it a little bit, but ultimately.
Yeah, it can be somewhat oppressive. I think I have mentioned to you off the air that I did the minority student program, and we just at Ohio State after I went to law school. And at Ohio State Law School. And, you know, it really isn't fair to say to every minority student, you know, well, you need to go and do this as opposed to everybody else who's going to go out and do different things. But
that's exactly right. And that's my message to my students.
Well, so that sort of brings me to, I think I mentioned to you when I first talked to you, what sort of was the final thing that really made me want to do this show. And it was that, you know, I read this article, a column really by Nick Kristof. And he was talking about poverty in America, and he was comparing it to poverty, you know, third world poverty in other countries. And he talked about a young man in an urban area, and he had three television sets, but he was about maybe to lose, they were about to lose the electricity, and there was no food in the refrigerator. And he was pointing out that there's real poverty in America. But for me, you know, having known something about, like, Navajo people, having done an interview with Russell Begay, and I'm thinking, wait a second here. There are Navajos who are living without any electricity, without any running water, without any sewage, without, you know, without roads. And I guess I started by thinking, is this the invisible Indian? Is this something that even Nick Kristof, who grew up in the West, it doesn't recognize, or so many people don't recognize.
You know, it's still a very serious problem in Indian country. There is a great deal of poverty. On the other hand, because of gaming, there are some small tribes that have great resources. And so it's quite this dichotomy between the haves and the have-nots has never been so wide in Indian country. Indian gaming turns out to be really important because, just to put things in perspective, the federal budget for programs in Indian country is around $10 billion to $12 billion a year. I mean, you can quibble with that depending on what you put in the figure and what you don't. But Indian gaming brings about $30 billion into Indian country
every
year.
Wow, that's a really interesting comparison.
It is. It's roughly three times. The problem is it doesn't go equally to all tribes or to all Indian people.
I mean, the Chickasaw, you're a member of the Chickasaw Nation. I mean, they've done very well with Indian gaming, right? They're very – and broadly, more broadly than that.
My tribe has done very, very well. We sit just north of Texas, and we try to do something that New Mexico tries to do, which is to take money from Texans as much as we possibly can. And that's been very successful for us. And so just by an accident of geography, we do really well with Indian gaming. Now, we're a very, very large tribe. And so, you know, the money, if you wanted to give it out as per capita payments to each member, it would not even be like Alaska. And they've been suffering lately too, by the way.
Yeah.
But no, it would be very small. So my tribe drives all of its resources into governmental programs. And so my mother, who lives within the former boundaries of the Chickasaw Nation, has someone in the summer that comes and mows her lawn, and she has a housekeeper that comes every other week to clean her house, and the tribe provides that.
No kidding.
It also provides wonderful health care and other benefits, similar benefits, scholarships for kids in school and that sort of thing.
So I have one follow-up question, but let me just mention, if you just tuned in, that this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and we're really thrilled to have in the studio Kevin Washburn. Kevin is currently a professor at UNM Law School, and he was the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs in the Obama administration for, what, 4 years?
More than three and a half.
And I sort of have a broad question. This is going to really show my ignorance. There's something like 560 tribes, something like
567.
That.
There were 566 when I began, and I got to recognize a new one, the Pamunkey Tribe of Virginia, which was Pocahontas' tribe.
So a lot of these tribes, like the Chickasaw, were removed, right? They were forcibly taken from wherever they were, and forced to go basically to places where white people didn't want to live, right? I mean, you know, that's where they were sent. And my understanding in general of treaties, and it's just this is way overbroad, is that basically the federal government promised health, education, and welfare in general in most of these treaties to the Indians in these treaties. So how come now we sit in 2017 and you look around and there's a lot of places, as you say, there are pockets, not everywhere, where there isn't really, you can say Indians haven't gotten what they were promised, and it's been a long time.
Well, I think that's fair to say, absolutely. A lot of people would say that most of the treaties have been broken and none of them have been kept to the full extent. So that means that a lot of people are not getting good services, and there are a lot of people living in poverty, and so the needs are absolutely tremendous. I will say that, you know, spending this time in the Obama administration, there were a lot of positive developments, but even in 8 years, it's impossible to overcome the legacy of 175 or 200 years of really bad history. So it's, we made a lot of progress these last 8 years.
So what sort of progress?
Well, one of the things that the Obama administration did that really set up the current administration nicely is, you know, there's long been a government-to-government relationship between the United States and each of the tribes, but it had become a relationship of litigation. It was at war, basically, rather than a positive government-to-government relationship. And so the Obama administration, one of the great accomplishments—
Yeah, there was suit after suit after suit. I mean, there were so many lawsuits, not by all kinds of different Indian groups.
That's right. And many of them were righteous lawsuits.
And they were righteous lawsuits.
That's right. And so the Obama administration basically settled most of those lawsuits, more than 100 of them.
Wow. And more than 100.
That's right. And so rather than having it, and let me just tell you that the position I was in, Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, it is impossible to serve Indian tribes well, which was my job. They were my constituency, in essence, mm-hmm. within the government. It's impossible to serve them well while you're litigating aggressively against them. And so
that's sort of the nature of litigation.
That's right. It's just you can't have a good relationship with somebody you're litigating against. Right. And so over the course of the Obama administration, you know, most of those cases were settled, and there's a much more constructive relationship now between the federal government and tribes. And so the new administration comes in a much better place than when the Obama administration started.
Actually, I want to talk to you in a few minutes about one of the cases, which I think is one of the most fascinating cases I've ever come across, Cobell. But before we get there, you know, I had never really thought about sort of the situation of removed people, removed Native Americans. And, you know, you remove Native Americans to these inhospitable areas, you know, an agricultural people where you remove them to a place where you can't grow anything. They're in remote areas. They're away from economic activity. So it's impossible for them to combine with others in economic activity, and it seems like almost necessarily you've got unbelievable obstacles that you have to overcome, unique obstacles that you have to overcome, and you know just infrastructure alone seems like such like with Navajos, for example, such an unbelievable obstacle, and you know how do you deal with that? Because we sort of expect localities to self-finance. And it's not really – whose responsibility is it really to –
That's a problem. There is no tax base because the fact of being an Indian reservation essentially means that the land – well, it tends to be in federal ownership. And so you can't impose property taxes on the federal government. So tribes have this – troubling situation that they are governments expected to provide services, and yet they don't have a tax base to bring in the revenues to provide those services. So they are in trouble. The it's just a structural problem.
Yeah.
It's
a basic poverty problem of any place, right?
That's right. That's right. And they have gotten a lot better over the years. One of the great improvements of federal policy over the last 50 years or so is that We used to have federal employees that would live in these remote locations and provide services to tribes. Nowadays, many tribes have contracted with the federal government so that they get the revenues that that would cost, but they hire their own employees to perform those services using federal revenues. And that has been tremendously successful, far more successful than having these federal employees in these places. And where it has been done, it's worked a lot better. And so a lot of tribes have been moving that direction to contract for federal services that are due them under treaties and the trust responsibility. So some improvements have happened, but it's
a mountain to overcome. I mean, were there things that you were able to accomplish in terms of economic development in the Obama administration?
A lot of things. One of the problems is, ironically, that tribes can't tax some of the activities in Indian country, but states can tax those activities. So one of the things that we tried to do was to provide a little more parity on those issues. So we would work to preempt state taxation of the activities within reservations so that the tribes have the ability to tax. The tribes always have had the power to tax Indian or non-Indian or Indian activities on Indian reservations, but the state also had the ability to tax it. So if the tribe decided to impose a tax, any company would be taxed by two different sovereign governments. And so
that's a real disincentive to locate there.
Exactly. And so if you can preempt the state taxation, you create a tax base for tribes. So that's one of the many things that we did to try to address those issues.
I mean, were you able to track economic progress for Native Americans during the Obama administration? Is that just an overbroad question?
Well, it's not. I would say this. One of the things we did was we increased federal spending in this area from—
Yeah. How did you do that with the sequester in place?
Well, it was rough. I mean, I started in the job and my budget was $2.3 billion to do things all across the entire United States during Indian country. And then we got hit by the 5% sequestration that Congress imposed in early 2013. The funny thing was my communication staff, when I was in the job and I was having to deal with the sequestration, they didn't want me talking off script. But I went out and had to talk, you know, publicly about the sequestration and the impacts. And my communication staff said, you know, you're really good about talking about the harms of, you know, these cuts to our budget. And I said, yeah, I've been at UNM for the last 3 years, so I'm accustomed to this sort of thing.
Welcome back, by the way.
Thank you. Now you can really talk about it. That's right.
Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm really pleased to have Kevin Washburn on the show. Kevin was the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs. You talked about settling hundreds of cases, and truly for me, one of the most fascinating cases I've ever come across is the Cobell case. It's fascinating for all kinds of reasons. First, it's said to be the largest class action ever filed and ever settled. Over $3 billion was the settlement. There was a Reagan judge, a Reagan Republican judge, who twice held the Secretary of the Interior, not yours, but in prior administrations, in contempt of court, and called the Interior Department racist. And finally, it really involves the history of Native Americans in this country, and through this lawsuit, you really begin to understand it. So with that introduction, I wonder if you could give us sort of a short summary of what the Cobell case was all about.
Well, the Cobell litigation began in the 1990s, but the problem began far earlier than that. And really, it began in the early 20th century when Congress and the federal government started allotting Indian lands, taking the land from the tribe and allotting it to individual Indians and then selling the surplus land to non-Indians. And
one of the things I read about that was that maybe it was a scheme just to declare surplus land, and really this was just another way to cheat Indians out of their territory that they had been promised.
That there's a fair argument there, because more than 90 million acres were lost to tribes over the course of the allotment
that they had achieved through treaties.
That's right.
Right.
So it was a real problem, and really the nub of the problem was this: that, you know, 160 acres or 80 acres or some amount of land, depending on the quality of land, would be allotted to a head of household of an Indian family.
A male?
Usually, yep. that was the way it was back then. Yeah, it was. I'm sure women still ran the place back then, but that was it. It went to the male usually. And the problem was that whenever that person died, it would pass. Usually there were no wills. That, you know, Indian people didn't traditionally have wills necessarily, and so it would pass to their children. And I will tell you, my mom had she was the 10th of 11 brothers and sisters. So when her grandfather died, you know, that would they had actually gotten rid of the allotment even before that, but it would have passed to 11 kids, and each of those children had a lot of children themselves. And so ultimately what you had is the problem of a single parcel of land in Indian country that might have, you know, 100 different owners. And there were a couple of examples that had more than 1,000 different owners because of this intestate succession of people dying and passing their...
Because it started like in early, like 1900 or so.
Early 1900s, right? That's right.
Right. And so by 2009, when you settled, there had been years and years of people dying intestate without will.
That's right. And so you had these all these parcels of land all across Indian country that had multiple owners. And when you have land like that, no one can make a decision about the land.
They called it an undivided fractional interest. Would you just describe what that means?
Well, it means that you own, if you're one of 100 owners in this land, you own 1% of the land. You don't own one little square that's on that. You know, you own 1% of the whole parcel. And that means that you would have to have at least 51 of those 100 people to make a decision about the land, because you have to have a majority. So what that means is it's impossible to put that land to any use, whether it's, you know, commercial economic development or, you know, protection for cultural reasons or sacred lands reasons. There's no one that can make a decision about that land because you can't even find all those people in many cases. So
it was held, the other part was held in trust, right?
It was held in trust
by the federal government as trustee for these fractional 100 or so owners of this 40 or 160-acre plot, right?
That's right. And in theory, the federal government was supposed to be putting that land to use, leasing it and that sort of thing.
That was their obligation.
That was their obligation, and then distributing the resources properly. And there was just no records that they were doing that. And so
they denied that for – that was part of the litigation, right? They said there were records, and they said they had been doing it.
They had a hard time producing the records. Yes.
That's why the judge held them in contempt.
Exactly.
Right? They couldn't produce the records that said they proved they had been doing it.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And so the case was litigated for about 15 years, but the Obama administration.
15 years.
That's roughly. And
wow.
When the Obama administration came in, they said, look, this has been a big old boulder in the middle of the river of this relationship. We need to get it out. And frankly, there's a lot of Native Americans that we were litigating. The United States was litigating against because of that case. And you can't be serving people well and litigating against them at the same time. So the federal government agreed to settle that case. And one part of the settlement was to provide modest cash payments to each of the members of the class. But the other really positive thing was $1.9 billion of that money was directed towards buying back those fractionated interests and turning them over to tribes in trust, in essence. And so that's a huge thing. One thing I've learned in both in government and in academia is it's sometimes harder to spend money than even to get money, and because there's so much red tape. But we were able to.
That's a remarkable lesson.
It's scary, isn't it?
Yeah.
But and it's good. I mean, we regulate this money so that it's used for proper purposes and not misapplied. But we were able to get that project up and running about buying these tiny little fractionated interests all over the country. And so far, we have bought almost 2 million cumulative acres of land, if you add up each of those little fractionated interests of land.
Wow.
And it's quite remarkable because it's tens of thousands of real estate transactions that we accomplished just in the last 4 years. So it's a major challenge, but we're meeting it. And it's involved spending more than $1 billion. There's $1.9 billion to be spent, but we've spent more than half the money, and we actually
$1 billion has gone in Native communities.
That's right. That's
already.
Well, yes, in theory.
In theory.
Now, let me tell you, we wrote those checks. We've sent those checks all over the country. Some of them gone to Ireland and Southern California. I mean, Indians live all over the place.
Right.
Native Americans have traveled. And so that has been really interesting where because we've had an interesting demographic study about where Native Americans are these days, because we have to write the checks and send them somewhere. But and some Native Americans have not wanted to give up their fractionate interest in land, because that was land that came to them from their, you know, grandmother or grandfather or great grandmother or great grandfather, and the sentimental value is too high. And frankly, it doesn't have much value. When you take a parcel of land somewhere in the plains and you divide it up between 1,000 people, what you have doesn't have much value.
But some did, because if there's oil or gas or timber and there's
a handful that were in the six figures.
The
sales price.
And you can imagine the government trying to account for this and pay it out to these hundreds of owners. I mean, it sounds like one of the worst accounting tests. It sounds impossible, which is what it was, right?
It was impossible. It's just impossible to do it well, and it never should have been set up this way, right? It was a mistake made in the early 20th century that we are now dealing with in the early 21st century, and it had 100 years to get really problematic.
Well, I mean, I think the idea of settling this case and settling 100 other ones is that's a remarkable achievement.
Well, the good news about it is it's restoring tribal sovereignty, too, because when we purchase those fractionated interests, we turn it over to the tribe. So the tribe actually then has ownership, rather than, you know, it was the tribes who the land was originally stolen from in the first place,
right?
And then given to individuals. And, you know, the individuals are victims sort of too, but it's been a real plus side to get the land back for tribes.
So we're nearing the end of the show, Kevin, and time really went by quickly, but my impression, and I'm so far from an expert, it goes without saying, but it really seems like the last few years have been really positive ones for Native Americans. I mean, even if you look at the protest movements, I mean, there's solidarity, there's pride radiating, there's economic development happening in different places. It really, really looks positive. On the other hand, there are these, you know, endemic features that prohibit, you know, progress, poverty-related things. So I'm wondering, you know, sort of in an overview kind of way, where do you think things are going at this point?
Well, it's really hard to say. I hope that we're not at a turning point. We've had a really good 8 years, and we're poised for even greater progress in Indian Country. And as you note, around the Dakota Access Pipeline issue and other issues, Native American advocates have really found their voice.
They really have.
And that's really important, because we need something that we can all rally behind. And to really make an improvement here, we really need to get together.
We are going to have to leave it there. I'd like to thank my guest today, Kevin Washburn, the former Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs in the Obama administration. Thanks also to my producer, Jefferson White. The executive producer of this show is Lynn Chebecki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this show are available at iTunes. Search Stephen Spitz. Archives of my past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.